Norman Cornett is joining us this morning. He's an educator, former McGill University professor, religious studies scholar, art critic, publishes in American and Canadian journals, a guest teacher throughout North America and Europe, and he's joining us today. How are you this morning, Dr. Cornett?
Fine. Thank you, Zelda. And I wish you a happy Canada Day and appreciate this invitation with you, Zelda.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Okay. Being an advocate of free speech and probably knowing more about it than most of us do, I want to ask you, when you look out at the world today and you look at the campus throughout the world, how do you feel about what's going on? The fact that students are no longer able to deal with both sides of an issue, that they need to have a one-sided view to grow up to live in this world that we're in.
Well, a part of it has to do, I believe, Zelda, with the evolution of the media. When I was young, we would listen to CBS, NBC, ABC, CBC, CTV, and we went there for the plain truth, for the facts. But when I look at the media situation, for example, in the United States now, because I'm a graduate of the University of California, Berkeley, as a kid, we would listen to Walter Cronkite, Uncle Walt, and we would hear what we thought, what we understood to be a truthful, objective presentation to the best of their ability.
Well, not so much so from Walter Cronkite. We certainly learned a lot more about him.
That's my point. And yeah. What's happened now is the battle lines are drawn and everything is made black and white, true and false, right and wrong, good and bad, and that kind of what I call false dichotomies means there is no room to question, to critique, much less to criticize. And so when there is that, we must ask ourselves, to what extent have we fallen into George Orwell's his novel 1984, into a thought police? It strikes me in university textbooks now, as you are well aware, Zelda, they actually publish them with warnings, as it were. This could offend, this could bother, this may prove too sensitive. And that kind of directive, your thought, how to read it, how to perceive it, how to interpret it, to what extent does that leave room for free speech, for creative thinking? And that is the be-all and end-all of education.
Well, Norman Orwell said that war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. I mean, those are pretty serious quotes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we're back there. We are going back to eventually, I hope, go forward, Norman. I'm not sure. It's very scary right now out there.
Yeah, there is. Well, part of it is what's happened in education, period, from preschool right through to postdoc. When we perceive the education of human beings as a product, as an industry, as an enterprise, the commercialization of the human spirit, of the human mind, and of human expression, we have crossed the line because we're no longer honoring the full-orbed dimensions of the human condition. It's a reductionistic, it's a one-sided, one-dimensional treatment of human beings and their potential.
What was it like for you as a professor at, say, McGill or wherever? When did you realize that the admin was seeing you as crossing the line?
Well, I have to say, I can't speak on behalf of the institution or the administration, but I did come to the conclusion that really what had happened in the minds of the student and henceforth the atmosphere in the classroom was, we are here to get an A, we are here to get a diploma, and all of that is so that we can get a job and get ahead. But you know, Zelda, a university, a liberal arts education is not a vocational school. It should be a think tank. So what I do in the dialogic approach to education is that whoever participates, whether they are undergraduate students, because my dialogic approach to education has become a subject of PhD and master's thesis, when I'm with doctoral candidates, what we do is we morph into a think tank of creative expression and artistic thinking. And because that is what distinguishes human beings from all other species on the planet. We are creative by nature. So to what extent do we foster, encourage, develop, nurture that creative thinking? And a lot of this has to do with giving free play to expression. Hence the significance of free speech. And I'm following very closely, as an American by birth who did my PhD on the relationship between religion, culture, and politics, I'm following very, very closely what's happening in the Supreme Court of the United States decisions. And really where the rubber meets the road here, Zelda, is the issue of rights versus freedoms. How do we reconcile rights and freedoms? For example, in the decision rendered last Monday, we sit with the florist, or previously this month with the baker in Colorado. Some people came with the idea that we have a right to this, and the business people responded, we have freedom. And so this is where we're at. This is the crosshairs we're caught in right now in modern society. We have so emphasized that I have a right, that to what extent do we factor in responsibilities so that we can enjoy freedom? And the fear factor, Zelda, on university campuses in higher education, the fear to not say what the thesis supervisor wants to hear, what the professor in the front of the class wants to hear, that fear factor has grown exponentially. Not coincidentally, Zelda, and this is one of the reasons I created my dialogic approach to education, what it has resulted in, Zelda, is plagiarism. What will get me an A? And I am willing to pay to do whatever it takes to get an A. I go on university campuses now across Canada, in the United States, in Europe, but I continue to see, you go on the bulletin boards in the faculties or the departments or the student unions where all the students hang out, and it's very clearly indicated, email here or contact me this way if you would like an A paper.
Well, this
is not
scary.
Education, Zelda.
That's very scary.
But this is commonly happening.
Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about England as well. The far right is rising and Britain is dangerously complacent about it. Are you aware of Tommy Robinson?
To some degree. Okay. What I am aware of and this is, you put your finger on something very important, a sea change is taking place, Zelda. There is, the move to the right, it's England, it's happening in continental Europe, it's happening in North America. What we're seeing is a sea change, and it is eerily reminiscent of the 1930s.
Very frightening what we're seeing. And I, you know, the influx of some dangerous immigrants that contribute to people's fears. I think that we're basically fearful. And
this gets back to the university classroom. When you feed the fear factor, freedom of speech is over and creative thinking is over. Innovation and imagination become criminals.
I don't know how I have never in my lifetime seen a president who was duly elected being maligned by the left. They had their 8 years in power, Obama. They were respected by those who, you know, most people said either I don't like him or I do, but he was duly elected, therefore I will respect his time in office. We are not seeing this in the United States now with Donald Trump. We are seeing the most bizarre kind of response, negative response, Norman, that I think is being fed by the left and is contributing to what is happening everywhere.
Well, it is very clear that the battle lines are drawn, and the first casualty is truth. And the endeavor to make this that my ideology, I think it's what I would call, Zelda, the idealization of thought. So it's not, when you talk about it's getting scary, the idea of alternative facts, of false news, and that rather than dealing with grounded reality, I have an idea, and reality must conform to my ideology. That is where the rubber meets the road in higher education. That we have, that we would go in the direction, and it used to be, of course, at my age, you know, 68 in a few days, it used to be that it was Marxism. Or Marxist-Leninist thought. There was an ideology and the endeavor to make reality fit my ideology. This is what I see happening now. And I don't think we can understand the valence, the traction that Donald Trump enjoys in the United States, where I'm headed tomorrow, as a matter of fact. The closest I can give to your audience, Zelda, is to refer them back. We talked about the news and the media, to see this film called Network, in which an anchor played by Peter Finch, who is the first person who wins posthumously an Oscar, an Academy Award for Best Actor, Network is in dealing with the idea that this anchor dares to say what nobody would. He says, he speaks out loud what everybody's thinking, but nobody will dare say it because they're going to be labeled this, that, or the other.
And they call him, he has a mental illness. Anybody who wants to speak their truth becomes, you know, a liability.
A crackpot.
Right.
And this idea that because and what we're seeing now is that some people, really the people behind Donald Trump, are ones who said, okay, I've had enough of this thought control. This is what I really think. This is what I really believe. This is what I really feel. And at some point, you know, when you put all of this into a boiler and it reaches a boiling point, that is what's happened, that the lid comes off. And it's very important now that we create, create a space for creative thinking and freedom of expression. And so in my dialogic workshop, Zelda, the first thing I establish, as I did, I was in Toronto yesterday at the Female Eye Film Festival at the Carlton Theatres presenting Joyce Borenstein's wonderful film, Lita Moser, photographer, An Odyssey in Black and White. And what I make very clear, whether I'm giving a conference in a theater like at the Female Eye Film Festival or with doctoral candidates, is this: the beginning of education is curiosity. And so the operative principle of my philosophy, my dialogical philosophy of education, is this: the only wrong question is the unasked
right.
question.
Absolutely right.
This is what we must foster in higher education today. And you know, I have six, and as of November, I will have seven grandchildren, right. And I spend daily, I'm with my grandchildren. I live a 7-minute walk from six of my grandchildren, and that is the best way to learn, is to rub shoulders with children,
right.
Because, you know, children are always questioning. And that's the kind of environment that we want to have.
So how are we going to get back to that again? There's no division line between what you feel and what I feel. The only division is that we don't get the opportunity to express it anymore.
Well, what we have to do, job one in education, is creating what I call a no-fear zone. Because it is that fear factor that paralyzes free expression. It is that fear factor that kills creative thinking. And so, and literally, from preschool to postdoc, we should create a no-fear zone. And I have no illusions, Zelda, that we're all going to agree. Dialogue does not mean agreement, because when we go down that road, you know what the final destination is, Zelda? It's conformity.
Well, and that's what we're seeing now. I mean, if you have a university, a student who's going to university now, if they don't encounter anti-Semitism or some anti-problem, they're not going to be able to grow into the kinds of people that they should, because they won't be allowed to think and express their thoughts.
Now, this is wonderful you would say this, Zelda. There is in the Hebrew scriptures, I'm giving the English translation, in the Proverbs of the Hebrew scriptures, there is a principle, and I consider this so practical from a pedagogical perspective, I use it. It's the driving force behind my dialogic approach to education. And that Hebrew proverb is, iron sharpens iron. Education should be a sharpening experience. It should keep us on our toes. The last thing we want, particularly in our very advanced technological world, the last thing we want is to become human drones. And that is the clear and present danger in education today. Become human drones.
So what do we do in order to bring back where we were? It seems to me that our less and less young people wanting to go to college because they're fearful of not getting the kind of education that they did in the past?
Yeah, there's a number of factors. First of all, particularly if we're talking the United States, it's cost, but it's also rising in throughout Canada. The other is, if we go into a liberal arts university, which is the case for most of them, and rightly so, we're going in with the wrong idea. when look at the very reason for being of the academy, of the university, it is not vocational school. If we're going in with the idea, I'm entering university to get a job, then we have missed the point. The whole reason the liberal arts program exists, that higher education exists, that there are universities, is to create informed thinking individuals so that they can fully assume their duties in the public space as citizens, that civic responsibility where I'm not going to be told what is right, what is wrong, but where I learn to inform myself and to discern what are the multiplicity of factors and dynamics at play in this issue. And I'll give you an example, very practically speaking, because I talked about directive education, the fact that there are textbooks now with warnings, you know, this could offend you, this could bother you, this could, if you're sensitive about this other, it's quite a phenomena. Well, in May, I conducted research in the sociology of art. I chose an artist, I chose an artwork, and I, because in sociology you need to have a good database, I chose over 200 people around the world to whom I sent this image. And Zelda, I did not tell them the name of the artist. I did not tell them the gender of the artist. I did not tell them the nationality or the religion or the language or the culture of the artist. I didn't tell them the title of the art they were looking at, nor the medium. Was it acrylic? Was it painting? Nor the dimensions. I just gave them the image. I sent it to them, and I asked this: what strikes you about this and why? And then I got back over 200 answers, because this was non-directive. And then we had a dialogic workshop, and you would not believe, Zelda, what came out of that, because I did not direct them how to see that work of art. And I know perfectly well from over 30 years of teaching this way that had I told them it was a man or it was a woman or they were Canadian or they were French or this was, it would have changed their perception. So right. I conduct research in the perception and the reception of art. And believe it or not, Zelda, we now have enough from these over 200 participants to publish a book about one work of art. And why did that happen? Because each individual entered into a dialogue within themselves. The artwork was a catalyst for a dialogue between reason and imagination with each and every of the over 200 individuals. Zelda, there's a treasure trove in every human being.
Okay, but what we're doing is we're cutting it down to zero, because we're not letting the younger generation become imaginative and understanding and learn from, as you said, they see something, they come up with an idea, nobody tells them how to think or what to think. What is the future of our youth if we are going to cut them down and not allow them to think the way they should imaginatively?
These are very good questions, Zelda. First, as you know, I'm a religious studies scholar, and one of the concepts in certain branches of religion is predestination, and in certain instances, even fate and fatalism. And when we look at the rate of suicide among adolescents,
right.
Wow. Among teenagers, this comes as no surprise. If the die is cast for them at the get-go, they don't see a future for themselves.
Right. Wow.
So really what education is about is planting that seed of your potential as a child, your potential as an adolescent, your potential as a teenager, your potential as a young adult, and your potential as a citizen. And then we, using this gardening metaphor, then we water and we fertilize and we help that potential to grow. Now, again, in coming from religious studies, in ancient Greek, there's the word paraclete. The one, it's the word that's used in ancient Greek for the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost. And what it means, literally, is the one who comes alongside and encourages and travels and journeys with you. Really, that is the teacher's role, to come alongside the child, the adolescent, the teenager, the adult, and to journey with them through their discovery of truth,
so
of
your
knowledge.
All right, so what you're saying is so true, because we have seen such an increase in young people, which means that they feel or felt that there was no future for them. And if they had been getting university educations and whatever, then it's the university's fault to not give them what they need to continue their growth.
Well, it is, first there is society, and then there is university. And what we want to give to youth is hope. But where it gets really practical, Zelda, and this is what strikes me, how many times do I see in university classrooms, no matter what I do, I make no difference. I make no difference in society. I make no difference in university. I make no difference in my community. And when we communicate, whether as a society or a university, that no matter what you do, you make no difference, it's game over. What I communicate, what I encourage in the classroom, is the power of one, what one individual can do and how they can make a difference, whether it's environmental issues, whether it's in the political landscape, whether it's in medicine or law or the arts, you can make a difference. I don't want to exaggerate, but This is the flip side of the coin, Zeldin. The minute you say that it makes no difference, you make no difference, you know what happens, Zelda? We have just exempted them from moral agency, from responsibility, they are free moral agents. It's called volition. So then, well, since it makes no difference, how do we understand, for example, the opioid crisis? And right here in Montreal, it's come. It is throughout the United States of America. And if we're listening to the health ministers in provinces across Canada, for example, British Columbia, why are people turning? Why has drugs become as much a part of daily life as three meals a day? That I'm not going to make it through the day. Right. Because we have said, you make no difference. And therefore, we have removed their sense of responsibility, of agency. These are the first principles of society and university today.
I agree with you. There are lots of people who don't go to university anymore and have a lucrative career and something that fills their heart. I wonder if we would take some sort of survey to see the difference between people who don't go to university and those that do and what their mindset is. But if we don't have professors like yourself teaching, and we have those that will conform to, you know, to what we see today, what's going to happen to the future?
Now, again, Zelda, you have this uncanny ability to pinpoint the Achilles heel academically. Do you know, Zelda, nobody talks about filling the heart on university campuses. That is heresy. That is taboo. And the whole affective dimension of the human condition, what is called in psychology, felt needs. The reason they're not going to university anymore, yes, it's because of the price, the cost. Yes, it's because, well, really, I can get a job another way. I don't have to jump through the hoops. But there is that other dimension. University, education today, higher education is not meeting what psychologists call felt needs. We should be addressing their hearts as well as their heads at the same time, because that's the hook.
Why don't the professors who are teaching today stand up to the administration and tell them this is not what I signed up for?
Because it's perceived as not scholarly, not academic, not intellectual. And there used to be, some years ago, a song, a pop song, I'm Too Sexy For. What's happened is, I'm too scholarly for your heart, your felt needs, your affective dimension. But unless we give, and again, this is in the Hebrew scriptures, unless we give the people a vision, they die. And so, literally, that's what's happening. The thought, the creativity, dying on the vine, because not only is that considered off base, because we're supposed to be scholarly, academic, intellectual, but intellectuals are affective beings. Scholars have felt needs, and so do their students.
Well, we're almost out of time, but before we say goodbye, I'd like you to give us a little hope for the future of our younger society, so that they will grow up and not need this marijuana and all of the opiates that we're talking about to bring them down instead of being the asset we need for the future.
Yesterday, Zelda, when I was at the Billy Bishop Airport, I got on a plane flying back to Montreal, and in the row sitting in front of me, there was a man and a woman, obviously from two different ethnicities, and their baby. I looked in that baby's eyes. All I saw was hope, Zelda. And when we begin from birth right through to the university, and we communicate just by our body language the hope, that we believe in them. You know, this is the one thing, and I'm glad you brought up, we should end on this note, that what really makes students flourish, blossom, bloom, and realize their potential is that they know we believe in them.
Norman Cornett, I thank you so very, very much for sharing your heart and expertise. I wish you all the very best, and I know that we will speak again very soon, and a very, very happy, happy and healthy birthday to you coming up.
Thank you, Zelda. Happy Canada Day, and I wish you, Zelda, a wonderful summer.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.